Welcome, everybody, to our captainless film experience podcast. We are without the presence of our dear Nathaniel Rogers, who is feeling under the weather, so we can all send a thought out to him. Hopefully, by the time you're listening to this, he's feeling better. But we could not resist speaking about the movies of the day and the late-breaking, late-release movies that are in theaters in certain areas now. I am, of course, Joe Reed from Decider.com, and I'm here with Katie Rich.
Hello.
From Vanity Fair, and Nick Davis.
Nathaniel's actually here. He's just tied up in the corner because we're going to talk about how Rooney Mara is a supporting actress.
And, we've all decided to take off our masks and support category fraud as the players in the game that we are.
Oh my God.
I want to go deep on White Oleander.
Oh my gosh, the betrayal of a deep cut.
That's hey, Nathaniel told us to run the show without him. He accepted the consequences.
Nothing would get Nathaniel on more of a revenge and murderous rampage than that, which I think is a good way to segue into the main movie that we're going to talk about this week, which is Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. The Hateful Eight or Hateful Eight?
I think it's The Hateful Eight, but there's an eight in the word hateful.
Any way to add more words into it, I think, is Quentin's modus operandi with this movie. Is it playing in any format but the Roadshow at this moment?
I thought it opened wide on New Year's Day.
Okay. I think so, too.
Okay, so up until then, it had been showing in a Roadshow format, 70mm, projectionists at your own peril, I guess. Although I guess there weren't too many horror stories of that I had heard, at least.
Oh, well, I've seen various people doing Twitter polls being like, how was your screening experience? And several of them have like broken or frozen or something.
Oh,
like
okay.
That.
Okay. So maybe not ideal. And then also with a intermission and a overture, one of which was more effective than the other, I would say. Katie and I saw it together. Nick, you saw it with a Packed house.
I saw it on the day after Christmas when all of Chicago was empty except for the four blocks around the Hateful Eight, which were lined with people.
Wow.
That's so where everybody was.
Hardcore Tarantino crowd then?
I guess. Yeah. In the rain.
What was the sort of tenor at intermission? Because the structure of the movie, not to get into too spoiler of a detail, it's about an hour and a half of a lot of talking, and followed by an intermission, followed by another hour of,
I think almost a solid another hour and a half
of craziness and violence. So I'm curious, Nick, because you were in the packed house. Katie and I sort of at intermission turned to each other and kind of rolled our eyes and were just sort of like, oi.
I needed someone to say, I don't know if I can stay for another hour and a half of this.
I had to sort of talk you into,
I know, I almost fled.
And then you shot each other.
Yes, that's what happened in the second half. But what was your audience sort of feeling?
I'm sort of a bad barometer of that because I hate intermissions so much. I just wish we were still in the movie, and I don't. And so I just sit in my seat and turn into like Madame Disavowal and refuse to talk to anybody or listen. And I was by myself, so it seemed like the audience was just super pumped for a Tarantino movie, which they were definitely getting. So and I got the sense that there was, I don't know, I saw some mixed looks on faces, but beyond that, I don't know that I can say. I don't even know how I felt about their mood when they were leaving. It was a little bit hard to read.
We had a lot of, because we were there at a press screening, and there were a lot of friends of ours there, and there were a few people sort of coming up and being like, no, it's okay, give it a shot, because it is very talky. And at speaking as a person who likes Tarantino talky, it was too much for me. It was too tedious. It was too meandering. You get basically an hour and a half of Kurt Russell, Samuel L. Jackson, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Walton Goggins in this sort of quartet wagon training it across the snowy mountains or whatever. And Tarantino's been able to make much less sort of sing on the screen. Mm-hmm. I'm the big Death Proof apologist of people I know. And that movie was just a lot of like people hanging out in cars and talking. And this just felt like we were treading a lot of water to get to the part where everybody shoots each other.
Which doesn't even happen until basically after the intermission.
Oh, yeah. Like, fully after the intermission.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of action that sends you into the intermission, but for the most part, it's all limited until after that. I mean, I kept thinking of, because once they get to the haberdashery, which is kind of their roadhouse way station where everyone gets trapped, I think it's deliberately trying to bring to mind the basement scene in Inglourious Basterds, where that scene goes on for a long time, and you've got this rising tension, and you don't know what everyone is there for, and then there's that amazing cut where you see
to the point where, like, geographically, like, where people are is similar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and like, there's all these reveals of, like, someone who's in the room who you didn't know was in the room. But that scene, I love that scene, and I love Inglourious Basterds, which I think is the maybe the only Tarantino movie that I, like, love.
Well, interesting.
Well, I haven't seen Pulp Fiction in a very long time, so I probably, that deserves another look. But I kept thinking of that scene in all the ways that Hateful Eight just wasn't getting even close to it. Like, nothing felt clever or tense. Even, like, the basic sense of drawing out, like, what you know about who knows what and why and what they want. Like, it wasn't there. There was so much opaque about these characters that seemed to be held for a revelation that, like, never really paid off.
Yeah.
I almost like the first half better than the second. I may have... That may make me weird in this conversation.
Well...
Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
I didn't feel sort of entranced, I guess, by the conversation in the beginning, but I did like the just kind of menacing mood build. I didn't mind the stuff that made Nathaniel, I think, the craziest. That was just the shots of, like, the coach moving through the snow. I kind of liked all that stuff, especially since it was, like, a showcase for the music, which I thought was maybe the coolest part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was really grateful just that it was limiting itself to its characters and was not setting itself up as some badass pronouncement on the Holocaust or on slavery. And it felt like it had boiled down to the people he had invented and the situation he was going to unfold.
But it gets there also. It gets to that point at the end of the first act, right? Where Samuel L. Jackson is telling his story and Bruce Dern is in the chair and whatnot. And I have been sort of hesitant to sort of, like, call out a kind of, like, offensiveness on that part, but there is, without going into spoilers, like, there is a sort of way that Quentin Tarantino views the world that is sort of laid upon that movie, where his kind of need to ride in on a horse and, you know, retroactively deal with matters of race in the country in a way that unintentionally, I think, or unconsciously goes into these really kind of, like, gay panicky ways of dealing with sexuality that, like, really bothered me and then, like, left me to stew all over that in intermission because it's literally, like, the last thing you see.
Yeah, and the movie, like, it's bringing in this gay panic element that has basically nothing to do with the rest of the movie. Like, this movie is basically dealing explicitly with race and a little bit with gender, but I don't think that effectively. But when that element comes into play, you're just like, okay, so you're throwing it in there as this, like, not like a shock value thing. Like, it's not asking you to, like, I don't know, it's not like an Adam Sandler movie, but it's definitely in there as, like, this, like, extra level of degradation for the story that's being told. That it's such a distraction in what I think what Tarantino gets so much credit for is the way he carefully crafts these screenplays, and the language is really purposeful. And so a lot of people defend his use of serious racial slurs as being very intentional, and that digression makes it feel like, okay, wait a second, you're just kind of throwing things at the screen.
Well, that contributes to my problems with the second half of the movie, where it seems like he's going for this kind of, you know, allegory of the American tableau and the ways that, you know, there are just in post-Civil War America or whatever, that, you know, it's a wonder that we didn't all just sort of kill each other because this is what, you know, how impossible a task Reconstruction was and blah, 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 blah. Not in those terms, but in sort of these very kind of Tarantino-y broad strokes. And yet it just doesn't seem incredibly well thought out to the point where, like, entire characters seem absent from that allegory altogether. My biggest problem with Jennifer Jason Leigh's character is just, like, I don't know what the fuck she is. Like, I don't know what function she serves in the movie or, like, her character in and of herself. I don't understand what her deal is.
Do you mean like plot wise or like
theme? Plot wise and like symbolism wise. Hmm. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, her being the only woman and what it manages to do with that is really muddy, I think. Especially given Tarantino's kind of, you know, justifiably lauded work with female characters in the past.
Yeah, and it affects my enjoyment of her performance, because I was really ready to, like, even if I wasn't going to like the movie, I think going into that second half, I was like, but I, you know, this has got to be where Jennifer Jason Leigh, like, you know, sets loose and whatever. And it just...
Yeah,
basically.
I mean, she does. And she does a lot in that second half.
She does, just not... None of it made a whole lot of character sense to me in a way that, like, just hampered that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, and I felt like there was a version of the, remember how in Django there's all the playing up of Kerry Washington's, like, she knows all these different languages, so she's going to be a huge asset to us, and she's going to really help us pull this whole thing off, and then we meet her, and she barely ever speaks, and mm-hmm. she faints, and she plugs her ears, and just doesn't do, like, Jennifer Jason Leigh sure has a lot to say in the second half, eventually,
yeah,
but I didn't feel like the character who emerged was the one that I'd been hearing about. I wasn't scared of her. I just was kind of grossed out by her, I guess. And even the fact that she knows something plot-wise that nobody else in the movie knows kind of turns into a prompt for the two detective characters to figure something out. But her knowledge of it doesn't really drive anything that happens.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Unlike the other movie we'll talk about later where she's only a completely clear device, this was not evident. I don't know what she was either. I agree.
Yeah, the Agatha Christie element of the second half, where it kind of, I mean, I didn't think that's too much of a spoiler, where it's kind of a whodunit of a locked room mystery. Like I said before, like, there's just not enough of knowing who wants what and who's right. involved in things. And you kind of get that. I mean, by the end, it's very clear, like, why everyone is there, kind of. But some ambiguity is fine, but, like, that's where the tension comes from, is, like, a sense of, like, you having one piece of information but not all the other one, and trying to piece it together along with the characters. Like, there just isn't any of that.
Well, it feels like that setup, that sort of Agatha Christie setup, is just the key to get you in the door. And once you're in the door, it's just, like, the end product is the bloodbath. And there's no other reason for you to be there. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was disappointing to me as sort of... On a surface level, I can get into sort of the, you know, the thrills and you know, excitement of that kind of stuff. I think Samuel L. Jackson still knows how to, like, throw a one-liner into stuff like that. And I think Walton Goggins is pretty funny. But it all felt like a really deflating sense of, you know, if you were going into that being really, like, high on the setup and really interested to see how this sort of, like, you know, gross game of Clue shakes out. It doesn't satisfy on that level, I don't think.
Gross game of Clue.
Gross game of Clue.
I like that descriptor.
This is Peacock in the slaughterhouse with the... I felt maybe a little bit more engaged by the detection aspect of it, just with stuff like the jelly bean... from the first, that, like, mm-hmm. that one shot of it and the floorboards in the first part and the plucked chicken. So I maybe felt like I got to participate a little bit in the sort of decoding of stuff, even though the movie also feels like it's telegraphing fairly early that everybody in here is complicit in something.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think what galled me more was that, Katie, you talked before about the kind of reveal that there are more people in the room than mm-hmm. we realize. But there's also this shift, I think we can say, in the second half to people who have previously been in the room. Mm-hmm. And it felt like after... What am I trying to spit out? After that scene before the intermission, which... I kind of responded to totally on the grounds of race and didn't find it particularly gay-baiting. Like, I realize why it would be, but the humiliation there seemed, like, completely race-based. Mm. And kind of, and Samuel L. Jackson getting to be the total agent of that.
Yeah.
But then we invent, like, three or four black people to shoot in the face who mm-hmm. weren't even in the movie before and, like, just explode their bodies. And
women, for that matter, just, you know, to add to extra identity politics to it.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, the one guy who you think might get away who then gets, you know, eliminated just as gruesomely. So it felt like his issues around that kind of bugged me the most. I think that was where I felt resentful of a Quentin trope coming back. Of mm-hmm. just, it seemed like this is going to once again put a different spin on racial politics or history of violence in America, but then just totally revels in it.
Did you guys feel like there was a, like, obviously he's obsessed with racial politics, but he, you know, Django was very explicitly about it. And I don't think Django is that successful a movie, but I think was more successful than being about race. And I can't figure out why returning to that well in the context of The Hateful Eight and doing it kind of as opaquely and weirdly as he does here.
I guess especially because it seems like it doesn't feel like much of a pronouncement. It's not even set up to feel like a pronouncement about race necessarily. Like, everybody else in that room has a different agenda, and Sam Jackson's vis-a-vis Bruce Dern is really crucially caught up with that.
Mm-hmm.
But once it just seemed to feel like anti-black bloodbath, and I know we're not supposed to, like, approve it or whatever, but it's so, it's just so confronting.
Yeah.
And then I just started to feel really cynical about all the public stance taking he's been up to about protesting the police and agitating against anti-black violence. And it almost feels like a recovery strategy for continuing to be allowed to trade in that stuff in his movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can see that. So before we move on, really quickly, because the visuals of the movie were such a part of the narrative going in terms of 70mm and the, you know, super widescreen and the roadshow and everything. Were we sufficiently captivated by the look of it?
I am no cinematography expert, but by the time it got inside, I just couldn't figure out the reason for doing 70mm for this. And I've heard people argue that it gives depth to the room and it, like, you know, adds into the whodunit element of it, but I could not see that in it myself.
I enjoyed the being able to sort of peer around all the nooks and crannies of the room while, you know, in the frame of things. I liked that aspect of it. I think it was interesting to do this format for something that is so much of an interior movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And not have, you know, your 70mm be an excuse for a lot of, you know, vistas, for lack of a. So that I did enjoy, and I think part of it was because I wasn't feeling the story so much, so I could sometimes just sort of, like, escape into the little, like, background of the haberdashery. So I did enjoy that. I don't know if I would necessarily feel like it's, like, the reason to see the movie, but...
Yeah, I felt the same way. What about you, Nick? I saw it at the same theater where I saw The Master at a pre-screening a few years ago in 70mm, and that one at least felt like the kind of weird hardness or surface of 70mm served these characters who you're just never going to get inside in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, like, they're so talky, they're so chatty. It's all about revealing agendas like that. I agree with you, Joe, that I kind of liked the counterintuition of using it for a movie that you wouldn't think would invite it, but I just didn't find the images all that interesting, I guess.
Yeah,
I agree. And like Anomalisa, not to keep pushing forward, but they both started. This was initially just supposed to be a live table read, right? And Anomalisa was this radio play, and they both seemed like neither of them was crying out to be rendered as a feature at these scales.
Yeah.
Like, they still feel like projects that weren't ready to be expanded.
I mean, Hateful Eight became a live read after Tarantino left the script leaked online, and he was like, "I'm never going to make a movie of it. I'm just going to make it a live read," and then made a movie anyway.
Yeah. Well, if only.
Born of a tantrum.
Before we fully transition to Anomalisa, though, I wanted to get into one of the reader questions. Nathaniel sent us a bunch of reader questions that we could dig into during the course of the podcast. We picked out a few. For this one, it comes from Anani. The reader is named Anani, or a handle, perhaps an anonymous handle? I don't know. I'm not going to draw any conclusions from that. All right. Questions for the team. Underappreciated comedic performances this year. They say comedy is harder than drama, so how come actors working real magic and truly comedic performances, parentheses, ahem, Michael Pena in Ant-Man or Jason Statham in Spy, ahem, are never given their due? So, Katie, why don't we start with you?
I'm not even sure if this counts as underappreciated because I think it's one of the things that's been celebrated most from this movie, but Joe Manganiello in Magic Mike XXL, especially when his mini romance with Andy McNeil starts up, I think is really terrific. And I have no real attachment to him outside of the first Magic Mike, so I don't know if this is surprising to other people that he's got this kind of range, but I really enjoyed basically everything he did in a movie that I didn't totally love.
Yeah, those are my favorite parts of that movie, I think, definitely. Yeah. Stuff with Andy McDowell, the thing in the convenience
store. The gas station, yeah.
Yeah. Nick, what about you?
I was going to say Bill Hader in Trainwreck, who I thought would have been great for what will be infamous now as the infinitely polar bear spot at the Golden Globes.
And formerly known as the tourist spot.
Yeah, exactly. But he is so funny, but not sort of... He manages to be as funny as the movie needs him to be and also actually kind of hold the movie down from just turning into sort of farce. I mean, he's what made me believe the relationship. He's also what made me wish the relationship... Well, we've talked about this before, but I think he's really crucial to that film.
Yeah, I feel like between that movie and Skeleton Twins last year, I think he's... really showing himself to be a really interesting film actor. I think it's pretty exciting.
And we talked last time about like dramas lately that feel like they're about couples and only the woman is getting attention. And this just feels like a completely different genre register where something similar is happening.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise and Rice should watch the Golden Globes together or something like that. Just have a couple bottles of wine. Mine is from a movie that I don't know if got wide theatrical distribution, but it's available on demand and streaming right now if you wanted to go find it. It's called The Final Girls. It's a horror comedy that I saw in Toronto. Melon Ackerman plays a actress from 80s horror movies, and then within the story conceit, she then plays a character from a horror movie that the main characters are sort of transported into. And slowly over the course of the movie, this movie character starts to find her depth and this sort of sideways realization of the fact that she's also this, you know, real person and this actress. And it's this very funny, but very unexpectedly kind of like moving and heartfelt, like unexpected for that genre. And sort of unexpected for Malin Ackerman, who I think if you hadn't seen the stuff that she's done in a show like The Comeback or even a TV show like Trophy Wife that she was on, she's been in a lot of like dumb romantic comedies or even stuff that like 27 Dresses that I will stick up for, but like is a, you know, fairly maligned. I think she does a very good job in this movie. I think it's, she's sort of the heart and soul of this, you know, movie that has this very unexpected heart and soul. And I think she brings a lot to it. And it's, I sort of evangelize about this movie a lot to the point where it's probably starting to seem unseemly, but I really did really love it. And I think she's super great. So,
love are going to help this podcast since they're, you know, not every movie that's coming up today do we adore. So why not fan out about some?
Yes. Yeah, I feel like, yeah, we need a good gush.
Once again, that was Joe Reed from Decider, Katie Rich from Vanity Fair, Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks. And they podcasted without me, your host, your usual host at least, Nathaniel. I was under the weather the day they recorded, but we're not finished. There's a part two, and that'll be up shortly, in which they discuss Animalisa and various recommendations on streaming devices for you so you can complete your 2015 with some great underseen titles. So come back soon.